second James Bond thriller could be more exciting than the first.
Krylenko. So he's back. Another Bulgarian they use as a killer. Take a look. You should remember him. This man kills for pleasure.
James Bond, that notorious, amazing Dr. No secret agent is back, and half the world is out to kill him. As he pits his murderous talents against the Iron Curtain and its velvet women.
Well, I'll tell you something, Coltorni. You're one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen.
I think my mouth is too big.
No, it's the right size. For me, that is.
From Russia with love comes Tatiana, bait for the trap. From the four corners of the world come the men and women who play a deadly, dangerous game of espionage.
Do not be alarmed, my friend. We will make you as comfortable as possible.
Ali Kerim Bey, head of Station T, Turkey. Krasnogransky, codename Grant. Chief executioner of Spectre.
My orders are to kill you and deliver the lector. All I do, it's my business.
M of British Secret Service. The woman called Rosa Klebb, playing a double cross.
Klebb.
Romanova. The door. Romanova!
Russia with love. They dance for him. They yearn for him. They die for him. From Zagreb to Sofia. From Venice to Istanbul. From Paris to London. Agent 007 cuts an inimitable path through the palaces and boudoirs of espionage.
Dems, you're hurting
me. I'll do worse than that if you don't tell me. You're doing this under orders I know. And what are they?
Even if you kill me, I can say nothing.
You're trapped, Mr. Bond. You cannot escape.
To the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me once again is our old pal, John Trumbull. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Very exciting to have you here again. It's been a long time since you've been here. You were on the second episode, and then you came back around the teens to do two Bond films, or sort of one, not a, sort of a Bond film, and then Spectre. But then it's been a really long time, so we're glad to have you back. We are here to talk about From Russia with Love. We're not talking about the November elections. We're talking about the James Bond film from 1963. This is the second Bond film of all time. A couple of weeks ago, me and Jared Albrecht talked about Dr. No, so now we're continuing on with the Bond series. Like I said, this is the second film from 1963. It's directed by Terrence Young, who also did the honors for Dr. No. So, John, let's just get right into it. Like, what's your feeling about From Russia with Love?
Well, I mean, I really like it. It's a really solid film, and you can, you know, after Dr. No, you can feel them getting closer and closer to what became like the classic Bond formula, you know? And this introduces like certain tropes that they have, like, you know, there's the pre-title sequence where the Bonds or the Bond double is being stalked in the garden.
That's a great scene. That's a great sequence.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's so much fun. It's the first time you see Desmond Llewellyn as Q, or I think he's billed as Major Boothroyd.
He's Boothroyd, right. Because the other actor didn't show up or something, which is amazing when you think that Desmond Llewellyn got a career worth of work because that other guy didn't show up for his job.
Exactly, exactly. And he plays the part for the next 30 years, or no, more than 30 years, like 40, I think.
Something like that.
And, you know, what else? You have your opinions, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, like I said on the Dr. No episode I did with Jared, is like before the Bond films were not as like readily accessible like they are now, because I mean they're not streaming anymore on Hulu, but they were for a while. Mm-hmm. Like I would always if I wanted to revisit the Bond films, I would tend to watch the ones I liked the best, which is not, you know, like everybody does. So I would watch For Your Eyes Only, or The Spy Who Loved Me, or what, you know, or the Man with the Golden Gun, tend to be the Roger Moore ones, but or Goldfinger on Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know, I would do all those. And I sort of put Dr. No and From Russia with Love in like that category of like, oh yeah, they're kind of the early ones when they were still kind of figuring out the format, and they're kind of dry and boring. That it wasn't really accurate, but it wasn't like I disliked them. But I just had this idea of like, okay, the series really starts with Goldfinger, so I'll start with there. So then when I went back to watch Dr. No for the podcast, I was so impressed with how good Dr. No was. I was like, wow, this movie's terrific. What am I talking about? Yeah, it's a little more straightforward than how goofy the series would kind of get, but it's really good. So I had the exact same reaction with From Russia with Love. In fact, if anything, From Russia with Love is even more kind of stripped down than Dr. No, because Dr. No, at least at the end, he's in his like hazmat suit and he's got the mechanical hand and it's got some of that stuff. This is really like a John Le Carré novel. It's just a straight ahead spy story, and it's got some of the nice trappings of the James Bond in terms of like, you know, the hot woman and stuff, like, you know, the Bond girl in it and all these other kinds of things. But it's of all the Bond films, it is probably up until like For Your Eyes Only, like the most straight ahead spy thriller, and I loved every minute of it. Like, it was really entertaining.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything in there that occurs that's as totally impossible as you would typically see in a Bond film. It's
right. There's no jetpacks. There's no, you know, cars that turn into submarines, stuff like that.
You know, they take like a baby step into the gadgets with the attaché case that he has. It's got like the knife and the sovereigns, and then it fires out the gas when you don't open it correctly. You know, but all of that is possible. You've got the decoding machine, the Lecter in the film, which was in the novel was ironically enough called the Spectre. they changed, understandably, for the film. And that was based on, I was just reading on Wikipedia, on the Enigma machine from World War II. You know, because like so many of the Bond films or the original novels came out of Ian Fleming's experiences doing espionage in World War II. And I think a little before. And it's, you know, interesting. He you know, took those experiences that he had or the stories that he knew, and he just put a little twist on them, and then he has a Bond story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the Lecter thing is a great MacGuffin. It's just the classic. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that everybody needs to get. You know, we don't really care that much about it exactly. It's really just this thing that everybody has to get for some reason.
Right.
I love, except that opening scene. First of all, Bond doesn't appear until 18 minutes into the movie, which is like pretty ballsy.
Yeah.
To wait that long to bring him in.
Especially in your first sequel.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You would think it like give people right up front. Now, I mean, you could say he appears in the opening because, of course, the agent that they're doing the simulation with is dressed to look like Bond. I don't get why he has to do that. Like, why he has to look like Bond other than just to fool the audience. But who cares? That doesn't really matter. But that opening sequence is just so well staged, because you're like, when you first see who you think is Bond get strangled by Red Grant, you're like, what the hell? You know, like that's such a grabber of an opening.
And that was like one of Harry Saltzman's ideas. They said on the behind the scenes stuff on the DVD I was watching, they were saying like, yeah, he should get killed at the opening of the film. And they had to reshoot the last shot of that, because when they pulled off the mask, the actor or the stuntman that they used looked too much like Sean Connery, and people weren't quite getting it. That it wasn't Bond. So they reshot it, and this time they used an actor with a mustache. So when they pull the mask off, you're like, oh, that's not Bond. And when I was looking at it, they kind of made Connery up to look almost like a wax dummy or something. His lips are a little like rouged up.
Yeah,
the makeup, you know, makes it look like Connery's wearing a mask of his own face.
Yeah, it's a really solid opening. It's really good. I mean, I love, and we can get to it later, get to it now, whatever, but the Red Grant played by Robert Shaw. I mean, first of all, everybody of our age loves Robert Shaw.
Right.
For one reason, basically. But it's so cool to see him in this. I love how quiet and tight-lipped he is. Like, he's got that killer stare. And he really doesn't say much through the whole movie until he actually meets Bond, and then he gets an old thing. But I love how he is just sort of this remorseless assassin type guy. Like, he's you totally buy that he is a worthy adversary for Bond.
Right, and he's just this blonde giant of a man, you know, just this Aryan killing machine. And, like, all through the film, I have to, like, remind myself, this is Quint.
Yeah.
This is Quint from Jaws.
Crusty old Quint, yeah.
And it's hard to believe that they're the same guy, because they're such different characters.
I love when Rosa Klebb goes to find him. And like she hits him in the stomach, and he doesn't flinch. He's just standing there, ramrod.
Brass straight. Knuckles.
Yeah.
Brass knuckles. She doesn't just hit him in the stomach. She puts on some brass knuckles, and he just he barely flinches.
He's a tough dude, man. He's really it's a really solid performance from him. He's one of the great sort of villains of the Bond series, and there's an amazing fight scene. But we'll get to that. One of the pieces of trivia that I discovered when I was looking up the movie was like. The only reason they did From Russia with Love as the second film was because President Kennedy mentioned in an interview that From Russia with Love is one of his all-time favorite books.
Right.
They were like, oh my God, let's put this one into production.
Yeah. And that one, everybody was startled because it was like a potboiler, you know? And it was, I did a little reading up on the novel. The novel was actually like Ian Fleming's fifth Bond novel. And it came out in like 56 or 57. I think he wrote it in 56 and it was published in 57. And and it was actually like he was doing it at a point when he was starting to get a little sick of Bond, and he was considering just ending the series, which, you know, thank God he didn't.
I think he enjoyed his house in the Jamaica a little too much. And he's like, what am I doing?
Yeah. What else is he going to do? you write a book a year, a few years later, they turn it into a movie. That's not too bad of a life.
No. I would stretch it out as long as I could for Pete's
sake. Yeah.
It's buying you all these wonderful things. I mean, that's a really interesting idea that they can sort of just repurpose these novels and move them around. I mean, it says something a little about Bond and that he doesn't really, at least in these early films, doesn't develop as a character. That you can just move these stories around out of sequence and it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, you know, again, in these early ones, it doesn't matter a whole lot. Although I will say it's interesting how when they did Quantum of Solace, there was all this thing about, ooh, this is the first direct Bond sequel to a previous installment. They've never done that before. And you're like, well, they do it right here.
Yeah.
Russia with Love is a direct sequel to Dr. No, because part of the reason that Spectre gets together to kill Bond is because they killed Dr. No, who was a Spectre agent. So it's like, what was it? Like, what are you talking about? They literally do it. And the first time they could do it is right here is when everybody gets together and Blofeld, who we never get to see, typical with his kitty cat. He's talking about, we have to kill Bond basically as revenge for killing Dr. No. So it's like, this movie's a direct sequel to Dr. No.
And it's interesting because like the filmmakers, they were kind of inserting an arc that didn't really exist in the books, because I don't think the Dr. No in the novels had anything to do with Spectre. And in the original From Russia with Love novel, he's really going up against the Russians. The villains were working for Smersh.
Right.
The Soviet the Soviet intelligence agency. And the filmmakers very shrewdly thought, you know, hey, you know, let's make it be Spectre instead. And they're kind of playing both sides against the middle and hoping to, you know, swoop in and clean up everything after the English and the Russians wipe each other out. So I think that's pretty interesting that they were shrewd enough to do that in 1963, like the height of the Cold War.
Yes.
You know, it's the same year it's a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, I have tried many times. I mean, as many times as I've seen this movie, I've tried to sort of keep the plot straight in my head, and I never can quite do it because it's just so sort of convoluted. I mean, I get the idea that, okay, Daniela Bianchi, who is the Bond girl in this, Tatiana, great name, she, you know, she's working as a double agent, and she is she's willing to turn herself over to the authorities because supposedly she's fallen in love with Bond from his picture, which is like a great, okay. I'll buy that. And then they said, and so you get, like you said, everybody's like Spectre is working the two ends against the middle, and then Russia and then Red Grant is following Bond and trying to actually protect him, long enough for him to get the Lecter so that then they can steal the Lecter from Bond. So it's like, okay, I have all that, but then as the movie sort of moves into its middle section, I kind of get like, wait, who's, what's, huh? And then I just kind of forget about it. I'm like, it doesn't matter. It's just, they're trying to get the Lecter. At some point, you know, they have to get away from Red Grant. Red Grant is trying to say Bond until they face one another. It's like, you know, it doesn't, you just kind of let it flow over you. It doesn't really matter too much.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and you know, they pack a lot into this movie. It's like a pretty dense movie. And, oh, you know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is Pedro Amadaras as Kiran Bey. You know, one of the all-time great supporting characters on the Bond films.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I think he is probably one of my favorite of the Bond kind of comedy sidekicks a little because he is so – first of all, he's very competent, which I like. I normally – like, you know, some of the other films where they've team-bombed up with somebody who was like a real kind of – like, a, you know, Sheriff Culpepper, you know, you're like, all right, come on. Like, this is a little too – but I like Kiran Bey a lot. Like, he is a really decent – he's really good at his job. You know what I mean? Like, he's a completely believable sort of secret agent on the side. And, I mean, you're always going to get me on your side if you show me a lair with a secret passage, which this movie does. I love that the secret stairwell is just behind some curtains. Like, I just love that. I am such a sucker for that stuff. And so, no, I like him a lot. And clearly the filmmakers did, too, because he was very sick when he made this movie. He was dying of cancer.
Yeah, he was, like, diagnosed while he was making the film.
Yeah, and they rearranged all the shooting, like, quite literally rearranged the entire shooting of the film so they could front-load his scenes first.
Right.
They got all shot.
They got all his remaining scenes in, like, 3 weeks. And even then, he's doubled in some shots, like, where it's, like, because he couldn't walk very well.
Right.
Like, if, you know, Kiran Bey is seen from behind and he's walking next to Bond, that's a double. And, like, but he just barely completed his scenes in the film before he died. And I mean, it's amazing, you know, and it's such a charismatic performance and it's so full of life.
He reminds me a lot of like Peter Lorre from all those Bogart movies. You know, he's just kind of, he's more competent and he's not as sort of sweaty and oily or whatever, but I really do like
him. Who is as sweaty and oily as Peter Lorre?
Well,
really?
That's a good point. And, you know, there's like a brief little moment where, for when they go to the gypsy village, which is kind of a whole fun sequence that really doesn't need to be in the movie, but it's just kind of a nice diversion to go to the gypsy village and you get the whole scene of the two sort of fully chested gypsy girls wrestling each other.
Finish your point. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, like he's the one leading Bond through that world, so he's kind of our tour guide. And so when near the end of the movie where, spoiler alert, Kiran Bey is killed, there's just a nice little moment where Bond just like leans over the body and he just sort of strokes Kiran Bey's shoulder. Just like as a little – and it's like Bond actually is sorry this guy has died.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a nice little detail. I mean, to me, the Connery Bond is like the most – certainly the most ruthless kind of them all. Maybe Daniel Craig outdoes him a little on that. But he's certainly more ruthless than Roger Moore. And so to me, the Connery Bond never seems to feel a whole lot. But just in that little gesture, you feel like that he genuinely liked Kiran Bey and he's sorry that his friend is dead.
Yeah. And they have a very believable friendship. You believe that Kiran Bey is a man that Bond would and could be friends with. You see why they get along. They have enough in common. You know, they both love the ladies. They both appreciate like doing a good job in their line of work and they're both good at what they do. You know, so they do have a lot in common and yeah, you really do feel the friendship and the chemistry between these two, between them as actors and between them as characters.
Yeah. That whole sequence. I mean, what do you think of the whole thing with the gypsy? I like it, but at the same time, it's like, wow, this part really, except for the shootout at the end where Grant saves Bond and we get, you know, get another moment of, that's how dedicated to his mission he is that he's saving Bond's life. It is kind of like a weird diversion out of the plot.
I mean, they go to the gypsy camp. I have to try and look at it through 1963 eyes. You know, they go to the gypsy camp and they say, oh, these two women, they're both in love with the same man. And how we're going to decide it is have these two have a big cat fight, and then the winner apparently will get to marry this other man, who we never see, by the way.
No, no.
And, you know, so they have this big hair-pulling cat fight for everyone's entertainment, and then after the big shootout action sequence, the head of the gypsy camp says, hey, you, James Bond, can decide this. And then the two women are both, like, waiting on Bond hand and foot. And, you know, it's implied that they have a threesome. You know, like, they both go into Bond's tent, and they're apparently both A-OK with, like, just being handmaidens to this guy they met literally maybe an hour ago. And they're like, yeah, we hated each other and we're fighting to the death before, but, you know, hey, yeah, let's have a three-way.
Bond gets a lot of action in this movie. Because, I mean, when we first see him, he's off with Sylvia Trench again.
Yes, from Dr. No. Yeah. And she's like, I think the only Bond girl to repeat between movies. Does she still have that record?
I don't know. That's interesting. I can't think of another example, though, of where you've seen the same Bond girl over two films.
I mean, not counting like somebody like Moneypenny, of course.
Right,
But yeah, and she even makes reference to, like, oh, hey, the last time you said that, you went off to Jamaica.
You ran off to Jamaica, yeah.
Yeah. And she's got, like, you know, she sees Bond's scar from, I think, when he got stabbed in that movie or something like that. And, yeah, I think Sylvia Trench was supposed to be, like, more of a recurring character, but they just never brought her back again after this movie, which is interesting. But it's a neat little tip of the hat, and it's, like you were saying before, it shows that this movie is a real sequel to Dr. No.
Again, maybe part of the thing with the gypsy sequence is that, you know, this is 1962. Plane flights are still pretty rare, you know?
Right.
And so it was like, this is when the Bond series was probably more about showing you the far off corners of the earth and showing Americans, specifically Americans and British people, like just the lifestyles you were not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as plane flights became more and more commonplace and everything else, it wasn't as hard to go see this stuff. So, therefore, it becomes more about the gadgets and the stunts and underwater lairs and guys with metal teeth and things like that. But in these early ones, it really is just like, you know, is it like any scene where Bond is in a hotel room? And part of this is just the style of filmmaking at the time was just like, you know, Bond enters a hotel room. There's a good 2-3 seconds where we're just watching Bond walk across a room.
Yeah.
And like they would cut all that now. All that stuff would just be cut. But part of it is that you're just like, wow, you're staying in this swanky hotel. That was still kind of a new thing for people.
Right, right. I mean, people didn't go on like overseas business trips and have big expense accounts.
Right.
And, you know, and there's a sequence like when Bond checks into the hotel room. There's like probably 2 minutes of him checking the room for listening devices.
Right.
And it's exciting as hell because John Barry's Bond theme is just blaring, and there's no action happening at all.
Checking room service, Brannan!
But it's awesome because it's like, oh, Bond's in the elevator now. Da-na-da-na! And it's great. I mean, it is a real window into like how they made movies in 62, 63. Right. And I mean, it does in places move much more slowly than we're used to today. But still, I mean, it's got all these standout action sequences. And
yeah, and it's still very involving. I mean, I said I like Daniela Bianchi as Tatiana. I mean, they dub her. So it's never actually her. But that, I don't know, that doesn't bother me because my favorite Bond movie has
so many people in these early Bond films. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's good dubbing. I mean, you could show this movie to someone cold and they might not be able to tell, you know?
Yeah, the whole thing has a kind of European flavor to it. And sometimes you're just kind of used to seeing films dubbed like that. Like, you're just like, okay, that's just the style of it. I love, I don't know how you say her name, Lotz Lenya. As Rosa Klebb, like that, in an era where, like, you know, you probably had to be like really super pretty to get into movies. Like, she was like, I'm going to be an actress. This, you know, this like really stirred.
I'll tell you,
troll looking lady, and like they found the perfect role for her because you totally buy her as this mean, nasty little, like when she is facing off with Bond with the
shoe knife,
you completely buy that she could potentially kill Bond with that thing.
I will tell you, though, I watched some of the behind-the-scenes features on the DVD, and they showed some photos of Lottie Lenya in her youth, and she was a looker.
She
was an ingenue. She was, like, married to Kurt Veal.
Really?
And she was, like, you know, she was, like, a big-time actress in her day. So she was kind of a casting coup for this. I was looking at those pictures and I was like, well, I sort of see how that's the same person, but wow, that's a difference.
She's got a great wound up energy, like in near the end where she is dressed as the maid.
Yeah.
And like, and you know, we know who she is. Bond mm-hmm. doesn't know who she is. And the way she keeps turning her face away from him, you're just mm-hmm. like, you know, you're just waiting for it to happen. You know, you're just like, oh my God, you know, and like normally you wouldn't think that this little tiny woman would be any threat to Bond, but she sells it. She completely sells it. And it's interesting is that, you know, again, you get that Red Grant is a real threat because physically he's imposing.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen him, as you mentioned, he gets punched in the stomach with the brass knuckles and he doesn't flinch and all this other kind of stuff. But the idea that, like, someone of a complete different physicality could be threatening to the pretty big Sean Connery. Again, that's just good filmmaking. They can structure the fight scenes in a way that it's a plausible – she's a plausible villain. And, like, I love that when he's got, like, the chair. He's like, it's a lion taming scene, mm-hmm. you know, where he's just fighting her off with a chair.
And something that's really interesting about that scene, in the novel, the novel ends with that scene and Bond gets stabbed with the shoe knife and he's poisoned by it. And the novel ends ambiguously. You don't know if Bond is going to live through that or not. And like I said before, this was at a point where Fleming was getting a little tired of doing the Bond books. And so he was like, well, maybe I'll kill Bond off in this film, in this book. And he left it with, like, basically just Bond falling unconscious on the floor. And of course, he caved, like, a year or two later. And then he writes Dr. No. And the beginning of that was like, oh, yes, he was poisoned and spent, like, 6 months recovering in hospital. A pretty ballsy way to end your book, you know? Killing off the main character, potentially.
Huh. I've only read a handful of the Bond books. I will admit, I've never been able to fully invest in them, partly because it's like they're really, I don't know, I hate to use this term because it's weird, but like they're very dated, but especially with their kind of like their attitudes about women, especially, like, you know, Fleming really like is like any day, you know, all his like kind of anti-gay stuff in there, like it's I'm able to watch these movies as a time capsule from what they were, and I'm able to get past the sexism and stuff like that, but like The books left such a bad taste in my mouth. I was like, I don't know. You know, it's so much more work to read a book than it is just to watch a movie. So I kind of like live myself in that world. But that said, like, I really do want to read more of them because I am just interested in the history of this, you know, of just how he created the things and sort of why they became such a sensation. You know, it's sort of remarkable that this thing blew up so much bigger than anybody could expect. I mean, this thing was made on a budget. Where I'm jumping ahead a little, but this thing was made for $2 million, and it made $78 million in 1962 money, which is unbelievable. I mean, this thing was like just a super mega blockbuster.
Right.
And it just, you know, Bond was just like the hugest thing. You know, it was like the Marvel Universe movies, but bigger because there just wasn't as much competition.
Yeah, and and they were coming out with them so fast. It was like one Bond film a year because it was like Dr. No in 62, From Russia with Love in 63, Goldfinger 64, Thunderball, then You Only Live Twice. And it was like, you know, each year there was a new Bond film. So, yeah, they didn't really have a chance to subside, you know? It just kept building.
Yeah. So the other big scene that I really love is, of course, the fight scene with Bond and Grant in the on the Orient Express. I mean, first of all, again, what another great detail to stick in the Orient Express, because everyone knew what that was from the book. You know, I mean, it's like, oh, that's another mysterious thing. So that whole scene, that fight scene, again, is to me, that's one of the great Bond fight scenes because, like, there's no music in it, and it's just the two of them in that closed, confined space just beating the living crap out of each other.
Absolutely.
And I love that Red Grant, again, for most of the movie, as I mentioned, he's really tight-lipped. And then he becomes very loquacious once he's actually meeting Bond and he's pretending to be the other guy. I forget the name of the whoever he's pretending to be. but because he has a dual identity.
And he's impersonating Bond's contact.
That's right. But I mean, like when he's there, when he's got the gun in Bond's face, and he's like, the first bullet's not going to kill you. The second bullet's not going to kill you. The third bullet, like, and of course, we thought this through. Yeah, you're like, you know, we as the viewers are like, dude, you're signing your own death warrant by letting Bond live this long.
Right.
And he's so confident he's got the drop on Bond that he lets it go on and on. And then when they get into that fight is so well done. It's so well choreographed and so brutal.
And it never seems like a choreographed fight to me. I mean, it never... You never get the feeling that like they went through this with a stunt coordinator. It looks like Connery and Robert Shaw are actually fighting and actually beating the hell out of each other. It seems like a real fight. It doesn't. It's just sloppy enough that it seems like it's real. You know.
Yes, that's one of the things I like about it. You don't get a sense it's a stunt thing. It is like some – I don't know. It's not so much that punches don't land or they're missed, but they just – it just has a really unsophisticated kind of feel to it. And, you know, you're like, well, this is what this life really is for this guy in close quarters. You know, like this is an ugly, brutal thing. And the fact that he strangles Grant with his own garrote – or however you say, I think you say, is that how you say garrote? I think it's garrote. But I mean, he uses that line to strangle. Like, that to me is like a particularly nasty, you know. I mean, it's one thing to get shot. That's pretty bad.
No, it's like cutting into your throat.
Yeah. And just the way he slowly drifts off, you know, and then Bond just leaves him on the scene. Like, oh, man. And, like, it's just nasty.
It's shot in such an atmospheric way, too, because, like, the fight starts, and, like, the first thing that happens is they take out the light in the train compartment where they're fighting. So suddenly it's like, you know, it's dark and it's instantly more dramatic. And then there's like a kick or a gunshot that takes out the window. So then you get all that great ambient sound of the train like whizzing through the countryside.
Right.
And so you know, it looks beautiful. There's all this great stuff happening and, you know, the two of them are going at it, and then they go into the next compartment where Tatiana, who's been drugged during their dinner, she's, like, unconscious and you know, they're, like, flailing over her for a minute, and it just adds this extra element of suspense, and it's really amazing.
The scenes with her on the train, I think, are really good, too. There's a great little moment where she's just waiting for Bond to come back. Because they're pretending to be husband and wife, and she's waiting for him to come back, and she kind of is like playing with her hair.
Yes, she makes a little mustache.
Yeah, and it's like that's just a great little like that's what a kind of real person would do, you know? Like when she's all alone, she's just being a goof, like anybody would be. I think I love all those just little bits of detail that they gave to the character, the side character. I thought that was a great moment. And there's another moment like that with Sylvia Trench, where she's trying to get Bond to, you know, not go off on his mission and stay with her. And, you know, he's like, stop it. I have to talk to, you know, Boothroyd or whatever. Right. And, but then he finally says, okay, something like, you know, I'll be there in a day or something like that. And he indicates to Sylvia Trench that they're going to stay on their vacation. And she does like a little clap with her hands. out of joy, where she's like, woo, like that. And it's like, again, it's just like, I like that little bits of stuff that they gave everybody to do. It's like, yeah, that's a real moment. Like, she's just really happy she's going to get to be with her super hunky spy boyfriend for another day.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's like, yeah, I'll be in an hour. And then he looks at Sylvia Trench and he's like, make that an hour and a half. So it's just like, oh, well, we know how you're going to spend that half hour. Like, as long as we're talking about the romantic stuff, there's another standout scene where Bond and Tatiana, where they first meet face-to-face, and she, like, sneaks into his hotel room in Istanbul, and she, like, climbs into his bed, and she's wearing nothing but, like, this black choker, and then you just see her under the bed sheet, and Bond, who's about to, he was about to take a bath, he comes in, and it's Sean Connery just in a towel, and this is the first time they're face-to-face. And, you know, the dialogue is great. It's this cracking good dialogue scene. And there's this – it ends with this amazing entendre where, you know, he's like, you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. She says, thank you, but my mouth is too big. And he goes, no, it's just the right size for me. And you're just like, wow. That was 1963, and they just snuck that into the movie. And that scene, from what I understand, it has been one of the scenes where they read the new Bond actors. When the new Bond actors screen test roll, that's the scene they make all of them read. Like, every Bond, they had Roger Moore, George Lazenby, Dalton, Brosnan, and Daniel Craig have all read that scene. And I'm sure there's, like, footage that exists of that.
How cool would that be to see all those, like, in just as like a DVD feature, just all of them all in a row, all the different Bonds doing that scene?
Yeah, and you can see every actor's own spin on it, and I mean, and that's got to be intimidating too, because this is one of the iconic Bond scenes and the iconic Bond movie, and I'm sure you know everybody who's read for that role has at least a memory of Connery doing that.
How can you not? Yeah, I mean, it's been so funny. It is funny to think about that, like, some of the details of this movie just would not translate to today, because, like, one of the big plot points is that Spectre has filmed Bond and Tatiana having sex. Mm. And, like, so they have this tape.
And they're
going to blackmail them. And it's like, nowadays, they'd sell it, you know? I mean, like, you know, that would, like, be – there were people that are famous solely because they made a sex tape. That would not be a career ender for a spy. It would be like, hey, on YouTube, check out, there's a British agent made a sex tape with somebody. Oh, how many hits does it have? Oh, okay, that's great.
That's true. I hadn't thought of it in that regard, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I mean, and they follow that thread all the way to the end where Bond and Tatiana are in the boat in Venice.
Yeah.
And he chucks the tape into the river.
Yeah, he got the film back, he looks at it, and he's like, oh yeah, this is something else. And then they start making out, and then there's a close-up of his hand just about to toss it into the water.
That's the only that final moment where he's like waving at it with his hand. That's the only part I'm like, I don't know, this is like it goes on just like a beat too long, where it's like his hand is just undulating for like a good 5 seconds. I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, you could have just thrown it into the water. That would have been fine. You know, that would have been great.
Yeah.
This is, in terms of other firsts you were mentioning, this is, you know, this after this film, they started doing the whole James Bond will be back, because this has it at the end of the movie. It says James Bond will return.
In Goldfinger. Yes.
So
and, you know, because they knew where they were going. I mean, I think there's only maybe one or two Bond films where they announce, like, oh, it'll be this film next, and then they change their minds after.
Yeah, I think they do that with The Spy Who Loved Me, because it says next will be For Your Eyes Only, and then they ended up slotting in Moonraker.
Because Star Wars,
yeah, for some strange reason, they did a sci-fi Bond movie all of a sudden. I mean, this movie obviously was really quite popular, not only with crowds, but with Connery himself, because when they did the video game, they did a From Russia With Love video game, Sean Connery does the voice of James Bond. That was the first time he had played Bond in 20 years, and it's the last time he's ever done it. He has not been James Bond since, which is remarkable when you think. I mean, I'm not into video games. It's just not my thing. But man, if I was going to play them, I would play this game, because it's like, it's Sean Connery as James Bond again. It's amazing.
I'll tell you, I'm not much of a video game guy either, despite like having once worked for a video game developer. But one time I bought like the guidebook for the From Russia With Love game, you know, just because like it has that wonderful poster art on the cover. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just there was so much neat stuff in there. You see all the environments and stuff. And I mean, I just bought that cheap used because it was a neat souvenir. But from what I understand, From Russia With Love was Connery's favorite Bond film of the ones he did. And I remember in one of the Bond-themed Entertainment Weekly issues, it opened with a story where it was like Sean Connery, he came across his grandkids were watching the film on TV. And he was like, well, what the hell? I'll sit down and watch it with them. And, you know, yeah, see Grandpa, you know, killing Russians and going to bed with all these women.
That's I can't even imagine that. I mean, obviously, if your granddad is Sean Connery, you're living in a real rarefied world already. But how weird would that be to sit there and watch the movie with James Bond
himself? I know.
Sort of nodding along. And apparently this is also the favorite Bond film of both Timothy Dalton and Daniel Craig, too.
Interesting.
So, I mean, this one really scored with people. And I said, you can see why, because it's like I said, I'm really glad that I had a chance to kind of revisit both of these because, like I said, I always sort of quasi-dismiss them as, you know, the boring Bonds. And they're not. They're not at all. They're really entertaining. And, I mean, this is probably – if you watch North by Northwest – you know, yes, and we talked about this on Film and Water a little while ago.
Where it's like, that episode, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you could totally see why Hitchcock was thought of as maybe a guy that could have done a James Bond movie because North by Northwest is essentially a James Bond movie with some slight variations. You could see like the different North by Northwest and From Russia with Love are would work as a double feature. They have different thematic concerns, obviously, but they have a similar approach.
Yeah, and towards the end, you have a parallel to that the famous North by Northwest crop dusting sequence where Bond is being chased by a helicopter.
Right, right.
And you know, and it feels very Hitchcockian. You know, like Bond's even in like the same sort of gray suit that you know that Cary Grant wore in North by Northwest. You know, the difference is that the helicopter is like chucking grenades at him and like has to assemble his rifle to like take out the helicopter. So it's a little different than a Hitchcock film, but you know, that sequence is so, I think, iconic in its own right. They even used a chunk of it in the opening credits of Goldfinger, even though that doesn't occur in that film at all. Right. They just show it during the opening credit sequence in Goldfinger.
Yeah, they knew they had a winner with this one. And apparently it almost like ran over budget and they ran behind and they had to kind of rush it to get it out, but this thing really does move, you know, it moves like clockwork and it doesn't feel rushed certainly at all. And again, especially what you know about how they had to rearrange the shooting schedules and all this other kind of special stuff they had to do, but it really hangs together quite well and it's paced really well. And the final little moment with Rosa Krebs is like a great little, just no pun intended, like a little kicker of an action scene, which is great. I mean, it's the train scene really could be the end of the movie if they wanted, because it's their best set piece. Mm-hmm. But then it continues to go, and again, you mentioned it has the helicopter thing, and then the stuff with Rosa Krebs. Like, it has a nice way of cooling down a little.
Boat chase.
Yeah, there's a boat chase. I mean, this thing really is just a really terrific movie, and it's sort of, you know, it's good to know that like so many other Bonds appreciate it. And I think it's such a great movie.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that it's Dalton and Craig, because those are two guys who were big boosters of, you know, yeah, let's do the real Bond, the real espionage guy and the badass dude. So I can see why this movie appealed to those two actors in particular, you know? Yeah.
They're the more tough, the kind of the tougher Bonds, you know, the kind of like grittier, tougher Bonds. So in your estimation, John, like as a James Bond mega fan, like where does this sit in, let's just start with like where does this sit as if, for the Connery Bonds, like where does this sit with you?
Probably at number two, I guess. It's tough not to put Goldfinger at number one for Connery's,
right?
But you know, this one, it's just a good taut thriller, and it would work even if it wasn't a Bond film, you know. You could take out most of the Bond tropes of it and it would still work beautifully as a picture. So, I mean, and overall, I'd probably put it in the top five Bonds, easy.
Okay.
You know, what about you?
Yeah, I think I'm there with you. I think initially when a couple of years ago, I would have put this one near the bottom of the Connery ones. But now that I've seen them all recently, I'm like, yeah, Thunderball and You Only Live Twice to me are noticeably flawed and a little too long and a little too drawn out and a little too in love with their own kind of cleverness. But these, Goldfinger probably, still. It's because Goldfinger really is like a perfect movie.
Goldfinger, there's not
really is
on that movie.
I would really put this up there. Like, I don't think that Tatiana as a Bond girl is quite as compelling as Ursula Andress from Dr. No. So, like, I'd say give Dr. No the edge there. But and I like Dr. No as the villain, but I really love Robert Shaw as Ray Grant. Like, I just think he's so intimidating that I like that how stripped down he is. And I think I've used that phrase just a bunch of times in just like the last 30 minutes we've been talking. But it's like all the extra stuff of that guy has been worn away.
Yeah. You know?
And part of it is the character and part of it is Shaw's performance. Is that he just doesn't add any of these little curlicues or these little extra, like he does with when he's Quint. he's adding all sorts of bits of business and things like that. And that's not a criticism. It fits the character of Quint perfectly. But here, he is just like a mannequin almost. Just killing, like almost like a Terminator. You know, he just doesn't care. And the only time that he lets his mask drop is when he's trying to lord it over Bond. And that's what gets him killed, which I really like. It's like, had he stayed focused, he might have been able to pull it off. But no, he lets his ego get a little ahead of him, and that's what gets him killed. So I would put this one in Dr. No as, like, really even, like, neck and neck, right just below Goldfinger.
By the way, how great is it that Bond pegs him as a bad guy because he has red wine with fish? That's Bond right there. It's just, you know, that snobbery is like, well, obviously you're evil because no good British agent would ever do that.
He's a sophisticated man, as we know about James Bond. He knows a lot of stuff. He knows about birds. He knows about – over time, we've found out he's a very, very smart guy.
He knows a little about everything. And, you know, I also – like, speaking of the villains, you got to love that they never show Blofeld. They just show those hands petting the cat. And from what I understand, the person they used for Blofeld's body was
Anthony Dawson,
from Doctor No,
like, right? Yeah,
Professor Dent,
right?
You know, and he has a great, you know, villainous face himself. He's just like those strong.
He was also cheekbones. He was also in Operation Kid Brother, which we talked about on the
show. It all comes together. one of the demands in my rider is that Anthony Dawson be in any movie that I talk about on the Film and Water podcast.
Fair enough. So. I'll go through his filmography and we'll look and see what else we can do.
Yeah. help me out. What was the name of the actor who was the voice of Blofeld? Because it was someone else providing the voice.
The voice is Eric Pullman.
Okay.
I'm familiar with who that is.
Yeah. But I mean, he's got this great voice and, you know, it just, you know, even though you never see a face for Blofeld, he has this presence and the cat that he's stroking, you know, it just gives him this memorable quality, and they carry that from movie to movie. They didn't follow up on it in Goldfinger, but they did in the Bond film after that, Thunderball.
Right.
And You Only Live Twice, they finally show his face, and of course he's nothing like what he was before, but but I mean, it's really cool. And I also kind of love that first scene with Desmond Llewellyn as Boothroyd or Q. Because they meet in M's office, and they haven't – you can tell they haven't found what became the Q character yet.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's so polite to Bond. He's like, oh, yes, sir, yes. You know, and he's utterly like almost deferral to Bond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's none of that usual disdain.
Calling him to the carpet and stuff like that.
Right, yeah. You know, there's none of that I never joke about my work 007. And the way I rationalize that in my head is like, oh, well, it's because he was in front of M. You know, he's putting up a good show for the boss. You know, so he's like sucking up a little bit. But, you know, and then in the next film in Goldfinger, when Bond's down in his territory, you know, that's the real cue.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, everybody gets like, there's the scene with Moneypenny, which is like sort of a classic Moneypenny scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of it, all the set pieces, I mean, the thing with the giant chessboard is a fun thing because it's just like cartoony and weird that these guys are playing chess and it's a life-size chessboard. I mean, it's a lot of visual invention. Yeah.
Yeah. It's this lavish set that they didn't have to build that huge set for that scene. And it's like a quick scene in the beginning of the film. It could have just been in some room, but the production design is interesting because they couldn't get Ken Adam back.
Right. He was doing Dr. Strangelove, I think. Right.
Kubrick saw Dr. No, and he was so impressed with that, he hired Ken Adam to do Dr. Strangelove. So Sid Kane, who was the art director, like working with or under Adam, I'm not quite sure how that hierarchy works, but so they hired Sid Kane to design this film, and it's a much more real-world looking film. It doesn't have the sort of over-the-topness of the Ken Adam set design. So it gives this film a different quality, and you kind of wonder what the Ken Adam version might have looked like.
Hmm.
You know?
That's interesting. I'm thinking about that. I love the opening title sequence, which is the that really is setting the template of casting the credits over a woman's body. You know, you're like, okay, we're gonna see that pretty much from now on, because that as you mentioned with Ken Adam, the first Dr. No's titles were done by Maurice Binder, and this time it was done by Robert Brownjohn. So right. He was changing that up. But it was funny because it's really Brown John's style that was retained after this. Because, I mean, pretty mm-hmm. much all you ever think about for Bond credit sequences are beautiful women with their, you know, with day-glow colors splashed across them and then, like, their mm-hmm. credits somewhere on their body.
Yeah. We should probably mention, like, Terrence Young, the director, he came back from Dr. No. And then he, like, took the next film off, and then he comes back for Thunderball. And Peter Hunt, who eventually directed Honor Majesty's Secret Service, he edited, like, all of the first five or six Bond films. And like, Peter Hunt's a big reason why that train fight is so amazing, because of the cutting in that is spectacular. They shot that with, like, three different cameras. And unlike most fight scenes you see today, you can follow what's going on in the fight. It's not like shot in these tight close-ups where you're just like, what did I just see?
It's not a Chris Nolan fight sequence.
Exactly. I didn't want to name names, but yes.
We name names here on the show.
Batman Begins has a lot to answer for when it comes to cinematic fights. And I like that film, but...
Oh, me too.
But the fight sequences, no. This is still, like, all these years later, after the film was made, it's still one of the all-time great movie fights, in my opinion.
Yeah, Terrence Young was a solid director. He said after he did a couple other movies that were sort of notable. He did Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn. Mm-hmm. He did a Charles Bronson movie called The Valachi Papers. I'm looking at his credits here, and I'm not familiar with too many more of his other movies. But he, you know, it's interesting if you want to track the sort of careers of Bond directors, because a lot of them never did a whole lot of great stuff outside the Bond films, which is
right.
Suggests that the Broccoli family kind of had a much, you know, you can imagine they have a strong hand because they've owned this franchise, mm-hmm. In perpetuity. But it's interesting that, like, you know, they having the last couple of films were Sam Mendes, where they're getting a name director to take them over when Terrence Young's name was made by the Bond films. It's the other way around than the early days.
And Terrence Young, he did so much to define the Bond character, because he was apparently like this, you know, suave, cultured guy himself. And Sean Connery, he had this blue-collar kind of background. And I've heard, like, Terrence Young actually, like, forced Connery to sleep in a Savile Row suit just so he could get used to it. Hmm. You know, and so he could just, you know, wear it like he wore it every day. And he was that kind of guy. And then you see how, like, the Bond character changes, like, according to, like, who's directing the film. Like, you know, Guy Hamilton has a more over-the-top style.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that in Goldfinger. And then Terrence Young kind of takes that ball and runs with it a bit in Thunderball, you know?
Right, yeah.
So it's interesting to see it bounce back and forth like that.
Yeah, and I love there's something else I realized, too, and this was kind of the last thing I was thinking of, is that this screenplay is by Richard Maybaum, which is a name that everybody knows if you're a James Bond film fan. But part of it was also written by Joanna Harwood, who did the adaptation of the book, and she mm-hmm. also did the same job for Dr. No. Like, mm-hmm. I'm shocked that that's a woman wrote the James Bond early movies. Like, I don't know if too many women that wrote movies. Yeah, I mean, there weren't too many women writing movies in the 60s anyway, let alone these sort of very male, you know, kind of genre exercise like James Bond movies. As you just said, that's a pretty progressive thing for the Broccolis and the, who's the other press?
Saltzman.
Saltzman to be doing.
And she was writing under, like, her own name. It wasn't like, you know, J.C.,
it's Joanna. Yeah, Joanna Harwood. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of exceptional. Like, you know, on Star Trek, it wasn't Dorothy Fontana. It was D.C.
Fontana, right, yeah.
And that was just the common thing for all female writers. They got more acceptance. I don't know if it was from the studios or the general public or some combination of both. But, you know, they usually went by their initials.
Yeah.
So you couldn't tell that it was a woman who wrote this action film. Or...
or the line about her mouth being the right size.
Well, yeah, who knows where that came from.
that sounds like a Fleming line. It really does.
I'd have to check the book. It seems retrograde enough that it could be Fleming, I suppose.
But yeah, so this is just a really terrific movie, and I'm it's sort of funny. There's a couple of you guys that are really, like, I want to do all the Bond movies. I'm like, well, I can't have one of you do all the Bond movies. So I'm spreading it out as much as I can so everybody can cover these Bond movies. But it's like, eventually we'll probably get to all of them, except maybe the Brosnan ones, because I don't know if I can sit through those again. But, you know, so far we've done Dr. No. We've done this one. We've done Spectre. So eventually you're going to set up my work.
Secret Service as well?
Oh, we did Honor Magic Secret Service. Yeah, we did that one too.
And, so, and you and I, we did Spectre when that came out.
We did.
Yeah. And we did Operation Kid Brother.
We did Operation Kid Brother.
You know what you should do? You should just have a big mega Bond show where all your Bond guest stars come together and we all have a big fight.
Okay, and, you know, there we go.
Like Last Man Standing.
Okay, yeah, that's the biggest nerd fight imaginable.
You imagine it would be.
A bunch of slapping and hitting each other with comic books or whatever. So, the Rush of Love, this is just a terrific movie. And if anybody who's listening to this hasn't seen it, go see it. Go track it down. It's really worth it. It's just a solid 2 hours of entertainment. It's just a really good adventure featuring James Bond.
You know, one more thing I want to mention before we totally wrap it up, which you were starting to do a great job of. But there's another film where Connery and Robert Shaw star together and they're adversaries. Do you remember that film?
What is – I'm going to know it as soon as you say it. What is it?
Robin and Marion.
Oh, of course. Of course, yes.
Connery is Robin Hood, and Shaw is the Sheriff of Nottingham.
That's right. That's right.
And yeah, and the two of them have like this sword fight at the end, but they're both like so weighed down by their armor, and they're you know too old to really have a proper sword fight. And I mean that was done in like the mid 70s, so it was like a good 13-15 years since this movie, and it's just interesting that they got back together as like the hero and villain once again.
That's cool. That's great. Yeah. I forgot about that. That's perfect.
I would have kicked myself if I hadn't mentioned that. So
that makes me think of a story that I had heard many, many years ago. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is because it has to do with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which I will never get to on the show. I can't guarantee it.
But that is the correct answer.
Yeah, I remembered reading about it in an issue of Premiere Magazine. Remember that magazine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were talking about how tough a shoot that was. And they were talking about that Kevin Reynolds, the director, was just mega stressed making that movie. And apparently, like, the production had, like, gone over, like, for 4 months, and it just had all these multiple units, and Reynolds was just pulling his hair out. He was so stressed. And the day or the two that they got Connery to be on set when he's playing King Richard, he's talking. They're, like, him and Reynolds are just sort of shooting the shit. And Reynolds is, again, so stressed. He's like, well, I'm worried about the horses, and I got this, and I got that, and whatever. And Connery just points out to him, well, you know, I did a Robin Hood movie.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, you did? You're right, Robin and Marion. And Connery couldn't help but twist the knife a little. And he said, yeah, we shot that in about 3 weeks. And Reynolds is like, you shot that whole movie in 3 weeks? And apparently Connery took a breath and went, pretty good movie, too. And it's like, oh, it's like,
and he probably
man when he's down.
Probably was just like, yeah, pussy.
Yeah. Now Connor is just like, yeah, I just made this guy's life a little worse. Yeah. It bad. Like, okay.
Oh, Connery.
Oh, Sean.
So, you scamp.
Yeah, absolutely. He's this big old scamp. So, John, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was so much fun to talk about. I said I just love these movies so much, and it's fun to kind of zip through them all through different eras and stuff like that. And it's great to be able to revisit this one because this definitely deserved a sort of reappraisal, and it's just terrific. So where can people find you on the internet?
Where can people find me on the internet? Let's see. Right now, I'm writing a weekly column at AtomicJunkShop.com. It's called Crisis on Earth Tea, where I talk about comics, books, movies, TV shows, whatever strikes my fancy that week. You can find me every Monday there at AtomicJunkShop.com. I'm also on Twitter as at Trumbull Comic, T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L Comic. And I'm also still an admin on the Back Issue page on Facebook with Back Issue, the magazine that Rob and I both write for.
All right.
So that's
a lot of stuff. Yeah.
It's a lot of stuff. I'm a busy boy.
Of course, you can find all the episodes of this show over on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And you can continue the conversation about movies and any other things that strike your fancy over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So, John, thanks again for coming back. I really appreciate it. Well, I'll go through Anthony Dawson's filmography, and we'll find something else to
see to do.
All right. And so thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
This is the raincoat they styled for Bond. Styled for Bond by Burton. Exclusive raincoat. Styled for Bond by Burton. The James Bond 007 raincoat. Only at Burton.